Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam. And again, our purpose in doing this series was to really get some personal experiences from the vets. And I think now that we've done this, Rick, what have we probably done? I don't know, 20, 25 or more interviews with vets. And I just remembered in my 73-year-old mind that years ago when I was working at the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, which is a wonderful experience, that one of my co-workers there was Bill Sidlinger. And Bill was a Vietnam vet, and we spent time together talking about some of these things. I think at that time we could still smoke in the building, but now you have to be suspended from the building to smoke there. So so Bill, what years were you in Vietnam?
I was there from February 1967 to September 1968, 19 months.
Okay, so 19 months. So normal duty was about 13 months.
13 if you were a Marine, 12 if you were in the Army.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that there was a difference from that. And
well, where the Marines have always got a one-up you.
Yeah, that's right. And where did you do your basic training?
Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Beautiful downtown, yes, Missouri. That makes sense.
And yeah.
What did you when you went to Vietnam? I'm assuming you flew in, and where did you land?
I landed at Long Bend Junction, Ben Hoa, which is about 30 miles north of Saigon.
Okay. And what were your impressions when you hit the ground and you landed?
Oh, it was kind of, you know, the movie Platoon really, you know, on this one nailed it. You got off the plane and you think, well, what have I stepped into?
Yeah.
Because it was February in Vietnam, and your impression of Vietnam is this rainy, humid country, and you got off the airplane and you stepped into a red dust storm. They hadn't had rain for months.
Yeah, and so, I remember that. That's really an easy picture to think about, because I remember in the beginning in the movie Platoon, as he lands, there's just dust swirling all over, lots of activity on the, you know, there's one of the kind of more poignant kind of films or pictures is where he's getting off, and like you said, he's thinking, you know, what have I gotten myself into? And there's body bags that are going by that are being, you know, and that's a pretty heavy picture to look at. When you got to Vietnam, then did where did they send you before you? And you were infantry, correct?
I had just come from infantry training. I was scheduled to go to the 1st Infantry Division.
Uh-huh.
Somewhere along the line, they decided to send me to headquarters area command, which was the circle around Benoit, Saigon, Tonson Nook, Cholon. And so I got assigned to a security unit in that area. And it was a surprise to me, a pleasant one to begin with, but it was a surprise. So I was there for a couple months riding jeeps and, you know, trying to make sure the bad guys weren't coming across the rivers and doing things like that. And then they sent me to a school for a couple of months on how to fortify installations. And so a couple of months I was spending my time drawing up plans for, you know, putting barrels in front of bullets and things like that. I mean, at the time, Steve, they had, you know, tremendous problems. A year before I got there, they had driven a car into a billet in Saigon and killed a couple hundred military policemen that were billeted there. So there was a push on to you know, start you know, putting defensive
you know, it's almost like you know, even some of the kinds of terrorist bombings, it sounds like, you know, even in Afghanistan and Iran, and, you know, a lot of the vets I talked to, what you're talking about was really difficult to kind of do, because you wanted to have things fortified well. At the same time, it was so humid and hot that if you had things that had no air circulation in them, you know, yeah, you would die from the heat, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, the big one, of course, which happened later, was the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, I believe,
mm-hmm.
where they killed 250 Marines by bringing in suicide things. So, you know, there was always a problem of, you know, going out at night and seeing what your places looked like at night and making sure, you know, that there weren't other people who shouldn't be looking at your places at night weren't there.
Right.
But, you know, they kept occupied, and that ran all the way up to Tet. And Tet just basically changed everything.
Yeah.
Because now the security forces in Saigon, I will use Saigon instead of Ho Chi Minh City, I just sort of stuck in time, had about six companies. And they lost an entire company in an ambush at the beginning, had numerous other things. That B Company of the 720th Military Police Battalion got caught in an ambush. It was, you know, just carnage. So, from, you know, trying to set up for things, spent quite a bit of time now trying to retake them.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, after a couple, 3 months, you know, things began to get back to normal. But the fact that there had been so many people there, so well armed, sort of changed the entire feeling of the place. You no longer thought that the people there were friendly, because when that came, a whole lot of the people weren't friendly.
Uh-huh. And of course, and then, in Vietnam, of course, they've been, you know, fighting for what, you know, years and years and years before. I mean, it was kind of like the Americans were just a new group, you know, prior to the Chinese and prior to the French, and, you know.
Yeah. And so, you know, I you know, came back, and I think, you know, my experience is so different from a lot of people who complain. You know, people came back to places like Seattle, San Francisco, where there was a tremendous anti-New York Washington, you know, where there was a tremendous anti-war movement, you know, had one experience coming home. I came home to Central Kansas. And that was, you know, worlds apart from the coastal areas of the country.
Mm-hmm. So you were treated pretty well when you got back then, is that correct?
Oh, I wouldn't say pretty well, but, you know, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, like most of the people in my graduating class, you know, served in services. Some of them didn't, but I had no problems with people who chose not to.
Yeah, yeah. How was the morale when you were there? That's one of the questions that we always tend to ask. But did you seem? Were people there? Did they know why they were there? Were they positive about it? Were they just waiting to get out? What was the atmosphere there?
Oh, I think, you know, I think everybody was waiting to get out.
Yes. Yeah.
I think, I on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd put morale at 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think that was because they didn't really know what they were doing? Or, I mean, why would the morale be low? Was it just
Well, I think it was just a case of trying to figure out, you know, why, you know, this is, you know, these people may be posing an imminent danger to you, but that's only because they're there.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting too. I remember, you know, going to the movie theater and, you know, they used to show newsreels at the, you know, at the movie theaters, and you know, with the previews of coming attractions and all that stuff. And I can so vividly remember this one newsreel thing where it was talking about Vietnam, and it had this domino effect, you know, and it had the dominoes, you know, going from China, you know, all through, you know, Southeast Asia. And even at my, you know, young age at that, and a lot of people in my graduating class, you know, went right into the service. It was kind of scary for me, but it was kind of like I didn't know what I was afraid of. I mean, I knew what communism was, but, you know, at that time in Ellensburg, there weren't too many communists around bothering me, you know. So, were you out? Now, you were wounded one time, correct? Or several times? Or
no, I managed to avoid that one.
You avoided the injuries, except the.
There's a difference between injuries and wounds. So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, injured, yes. Wounded, no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is that I've run into so many vets is this issue of Agent Orange and the dioxin. And just interviewed a guy who was, on Swift boats. Up and down the Mekong, and yes. there was a tiny, I can't remember the name of it, but an island that they took over and used for a kind of a supply base. But he said that You know, he remembers people loading these, you know, dumping these 50-gallon containers of Agent Orange into these kind of distributor, kind of fan-type things that fit on the helicopters, and, you know, with no masks, and, you know, it's just like pouring flour out of a sack. It just was, you know, a big cloud around you, you know. And I think that there are more, from what I understand, there are more people that if you were in Vietnam, you were exposed to Agent Orange, and that just flat out is it. It was on all the rivers. It was on all the air bases. It was, you know, landing zones.
Food supply.
What's that?
Food supply.
Yeah, yeah. Rice, the rice paddies, still having tremendous birth defects in the water. You know, dioxin, I don't know what the half-life of it is, but I know it's a long time. And did you experience any issues with that, with Agent Orange?
Oh, yes, I did. And it was one time where having a law degree sort of was worth its weight in gold, because you can put together your argument with you know, what your ratings should be because of the dioxin point. You know, made dealing with the Veterans Administration a whole lot easier than I think it might have otherwise been.
Yeah, interesting. You know, working in the Office for Civil Rights, and now I do, I wouldn't say quite a bit, but, you know, I probably do 5 or 6 cases a year of doing professional witness work related to ADA kinds of things. I will say that the Office for Civil Rights did give me some skill in writing important things as well as baloney. And, I remember my wife saying one, and I used it on my dissertation, my wife saying one time, I'd written this dissertation that was accepted, and it was like 400 pages long. And my wife said, she read it and she said, you know, I could have put this on about 3 pages. And I said, that's a reason you go to doctoral school, to learn how to take 3 pages and turn it into 400. That's the key there. But I would imagine that your law degree, and did you get your law degree after you came out of the military?
Oh, yeah, I got both my college degree and my law degree after I came out of the military.
So you got that on, what, GI Bill, or do you got help with that?
It's always, you know, everybody talks about the, you know, hostility from, you know, the anti-war demonstrators. To me, the most hostility I ever felt from anyone in this country was Gerald Ford, President of the United States, a Republican.
Right.
Successor Richard Nixon, who vetoed an increase in spending for the Veterans GI Bill.
Really? I did not know that.
And it was, he was running around with his win button, flip inflation now. And, you know, he said, you know, he's going to make a point of, you know, that there's nothing, you know, we've got to stop spending money. Well, when you take the GI Bill that the Vietnam veterans got compared to the World War II veterans, it was, you know, paled in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my family was a beneficiary of the World War II Veterans Bill, because my wife's father was served in the Marine Corps officer in the Second World War.
Uh-huh.
And he came back, and he had a master's degree before he went to the Marine Corps, and he spent 3 years at Eastman School of music, getting his doctorate degree.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my wife has pictures of him there. He's there with his two kids in the housing that was provided for him, the tuition was provided for him, a living stipend was provided for him. It was a very nice deal, like I say. You know, my wife benefited from it, and indirectly I benefited from the fact that he did that, you know. So, but it wasn't, you know, compared to, it was so far superior to what Vietnam veterans got that I don't think people should have been sitting around be towing bills.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, that was my own personal call.
Yeah. Well, if you think, as I think about it too, and again, you know, and this is just my perception of it, but, you know, with those veterans that came out of World War II and even the Korean War, like my uncle, the injuries were, you know, you lost an eye, you lost a limb, or had other kinds of, you know, physical types of injuries. You also had, of course, that they called, you know, PTSD, they call it shell shock or, you know, something else. I mean, that was certainly around, but, I think the difference is that they either had injuries that they could deal with that were static, but not like Agent Orange. Whereas Agent Orange is hitting people 50 years later, and I think the average the gentleman I talked to before said that the average age for a Vietnam vet is 65 to 67. Or, you know...
Oh, my gosh, I'm above average.
What's that?
Well, I'm 77, so I'm...
You're bringing the figures up, you know, and it's...
Yeah, well, yeah. I sort of went early on, too, so...
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, I have to say that, you know, as a person in a high level injury in a person in a wheelchair, you know, my life expectancy was kind of in that same range, and but I would also say my longevity is not also because I didn't do some pretty stupid things and when I was younger. You know, quick story, I was not much of an athlete in high school. I was not very macho in high school. I got by and made friends by, you know, being a jokester and doing stupid things. And so when I went in to do my Army physical, which the building is still exists, it's way down there by Pier 70 on the dock. My mom gave me a note to give to the guy when I had my draft physical. It was almost like PE. Steve has the, what is he? I give Steve permission to get out of the Army. You know, it was like, it did not work. But anyhow, it was, it was a good attempt, I guess. What are your thoughts about Vietnam now? Is it, you know, was it, do you think it was ever winnable? Do you think we should ever have gone in? I mean, I guess that's a little bit of a political question, but I think, a fair question.
Well, I don't know how many people you've talked to who've gone back to Vietnam. And I went back, it wasn't exactly planned this way. My wife and I went back for what was the 45th anniversary of the Tet Offensive. And I have never in my life seen something change so much for the better than that was. I mean, it was so good compared to what it was.
Mm-hmm.
People were happy. children could play in the streets. Everybody seemed to have a job. New construction all over the place. And we went from one end of the country to the other. I mean, it wasn't like the rural areas were horrible. When we're in the rural areas, you had the kids coming by on their bicycles, going home to eat lunch during the noon break and siesta from school. You know, kids were going to school, which is, considering what things were like when we were there, is an amazing thing. And so, yeah, I have very good feelings about what they did once we left.
Mm-hmm.
It may not have satisfied everybody's idea of how countries should be run, but I think peace, you know, is such a bonus to countries. It really made a difference.
Well, you know, and again, look, I'm not an expert on defense activities or any of those things. But, you know, what I see going on right now in Ukraine, and I have, you know, a lot of my graduate students that I had have relatives there. And it just seems like such a waste, blowing up these buildings even my graduate students that are Russian are extremely opposed to what's going on. And I agree with you about peace. I think that, you know, to some degree, war is kind of, I guess I'm simplifying it, but, you know, whichever side kills them more on the other hand is the one that's the winner. And that seems to be like not a win-win, but a lose-lose. And what do you think about that? What do you think about Ukraine?
Well, I think it's, it's one of those things where everybody was convinced Russia was going to end this thing in 3 days. And I think it's kind of the hubris about a well-armed, you know, industrial country versus a not-so-well-armed agrarian opponent.
Yeah,
and,
go ahead.
You know, it just doesn't always work out that way.
I mean,
from the time of the Revolutionary War here, where you had all these professional soldiers coming from Europe, you know, fighting a bunch of farmers and you know.
Yeah.
And they lost.
Yeah. And it does seem to me like there are some similarities. In other words, you know, like in Vietnam, you know, there were so many people that that were in that community that were, you know, fighting. And I mean, there's no question that that United States had so much more, firepower and technology and equipment. But, it's kind of the same type of thing in Ukraine, I think, as you've got. I don't think that Putin ever thought that, that he would have this kind of resistance. And now they're saying that one of the cities that, you know, was taken over by the Crimean is, now kind of being taken back by the locals. So it's crazy. Well, you know what? I don't hope I live long enough to see World War IV, or III, or whatever. But I am glad to be alive every day, and I sure enjoy it. And it would be nice, Bill, to get together at the Metropolitan Grill or someplace and have lunch and just. Talk some good BS. So I can say BS because it stands for bunnies and I don't know what else. But anyhow, any final thoughts?
Well, one final thought. After all this, I had a son who's now, he's a professional military.
Okay.
And the changes in the military are so tremendous. You know, it's nothing like the draft army that the Vietnam veterans served in. It's professional, you know, good guys.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I think that I see so many young, you know, young men coming out of the military now and, you know, husbands and wives of, you know, my graduate students. And, you know, we get a lot of kids down there by, you know, Fort Lewis. But,
oh, yeah.
I mean, they've gotten amazing educations and amazing, you know, vocations from the training that they did receive in the military. So I think that that is a positive, and maybe we'll think a little bit more about the things that we get involved in. So I think with that, I'm going to close this segment. And, Bill, thank you. Thank you very much for chatting with me for a bit. And I'll give you a call, and when I get up in your neck of the woods, you know, we can go out and have a beer. Sound good?
Okay.
Okay, Bill.
Sounds good.
Okay, take care and say hello to Randy for me.
Okay,
bye-bye.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.